Hello and welcome to the Convex Conversation with me, broadcaster Helen Fospero. This week we're off to Switzerland for part one of a two-part special with a man who's still regarded as one of the finest racing drivers of all time, Formula One icon and legend Sir Jackie Stewart. Nicknamed the Flying Scot, Sir Jackie won three World Championship titles and a record 27 Grand Prix victories, his first in Monza.
76 laps to cover, but on the 64th, Clark's Lotus let him down and he had to retire. This was the chance for the BRMs to get their own back. Jackie Stewart in one of them brought off a fantastically narrow win, beating Hill in the other BRM by just over 3 seconds. A Grand Prix win for this young Scottish driver in his first Grand Prix season.
After humble beginnings selling petrol and working as a mechanic at his parents' garage in Dumbartonshire, Sir Jackie competed from 1965 to 1973, at the height of the swinging 60s, when Formula One was glamorous and heady, but extraordinarily dangerous. He's widely credited for dramatically improving the safety of motor racing. As well as being one of the fastest drivers in the world, he was a much-loved commentator for ABC America, inspired young Ford engineers, owned his own Paul Stewart Formula One team, and remains one of the sport's greatest ambassadors, still in the paddock and on the starting grid. Sir Jackie, it really, truly is an honour to speak to you today. Thank you for finding time. How are you?
Well, very well. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming on board. I'm well. I'm currently in Switzerland. I live here most of my life, although I keep my home in England, which is very nice. But my life is travel still at this day because I'm still involved in Formula One. In a few days' time, I'm heading off to another Grand Prix. So life hasn't changed very much in a strange way.
Well, you're still, Sir Jackie, living life in the fast lane. What is occupying your time at the moment? You mentioned there still Formula One.
Well, I still love the sport. It's a global sport. That's what I was involved in. You know, before I was a racing driver, I shot for Scotland and Great Britain in trap shooting. But motor racing took me on a totally different level of life. Even in my day, which was some years back, it was pretty global because everybody in the world drives a car, it seems. And whether it's a Ferrari or whether it's a Fiat, it's just a passion that people have, men and women. And now we've got more women involved. We've got more young people coming to the racetrack. So my life, somehow or other, has hardly changed because I'm still visiting many of the same racetracks as I actually drove in my career. So it's been a happy trip.
You were an Olympic standard shooter, but how did you get into racing in the first place?
Well, I was a mechanic in a garage. I'm an extreme dyslexic. I can't read or write. I don't know the national anthem. I don't know the Lord's Prayer. I'm a real dummy when it comes to, in the world of education particularly, that proved itself because I left school with little or no knowledge at all. I'm extreme in my illness, if I call it that. But I worked in my father's garage. It was a wee garage. It was very small and just outside Dumbarton, a place called Dumbuck. So I started off by selling petrol and got more tips than I did wages. And then I bought a wee car before I was 17 when I was allowed to drive on my earnings of tips. So I then became a motor mechanic, went to night school and became a City and Guilds owner of a degree that told me I was a motor mechanic. And from that point on, really, my life was cars. My shooting was, of course, an exciting part of my life, shooting for Scotland and Great Britain. You know, took me around Europe, definitely, and won most of the major championships. So sport was something that came into my life pretty strongly before I was a racing driver. And that only began because there was a very nice young man in Scotland, in Glasgow, actually, whose family would not allow him to race. He came from a fairly rich family and he was the only son for a company that didn't want to lose their only son in driving racing cars. So he allowed me to mechanic to begin with and then to drive his cars. So that was the early part of my life and it was a great part of my life. I loved where I had my home. I was born in the bungalow right next to the garage and in the dining room table, actually, I was born.
Were you born on the dining room table?
It's been a lovely life that I've had so far, at least.
Wow, I didn't know you were born on the dining room table. There's something that you don't hear very often.
Yeah, I went to the house the other day, Rock View, and it's a bungalow still next to the garage that's no longer our family, of course, but it was memory lane, and I went back into the room and couldn't believe I was born on that wee table.
And what was your first wee car, and how did you feel when you first started driving? Because for me, I fell in love with driving the moment I could get behind the wheel.
Well, I was pretty hungry to get behind the wheel, that was for sure. My brother was a racing driver. He was 8 years older than me, so I was maybe a surprise to the family when I arrived. But he was a good racing driver, so I went to a lot of races with him. But that was an expensive sport in those days, as it still is today, of course. But my shooting took so much of my time. It wasn't until I got married, actually, to Helen all those years ago, I couldn't afford an amateur sport like Helen, like clay pigeon shooting, with an expensive girl called Helen, as all girls are.
We're very expensive, Helens.
Well, anyway, I started racing only because of this man and his lovely cars and club racing, and then I got spotted by a Curia Cos, a wonderful racing team in Scotland. Won Le Mans a couple of times as a private entrance. It was a great big jump for me to get invited by them to race. And then after that, somehow or other, I was going down south with them racing all around the UK. And I was spotted by a man called Ken Tyrrell. And there, that was the beginning of the big rise, really.
World champion John Surtees and Graham Hill, one of two former champions, being challenged by the new names in motorsport, Mike Spence and Jackie Stewart. It's the International Trophy Race at Silverstone. Graham Hill, BRM, number three in the lead. The Surtees Ferrari close behind. Now Graham Hill's teammate, newcomer Jackie Stewart, number four, took over the lead. Although his first big race was only last season, Stewart won at an average of nearly 112. Jackie Stewart has won more than a trophy. He's gained a place on the championship ladder.
Oh, and the rest was history. But so, Jackie, can you paint a picture for me? I was born in 1966, I think, when you were probably at Spa. What was racing like in the late 60s and the early 70s? Because it's so different to how it is now, obviously.
Well, first of all, the spirit was higher. The camaraderie was greater. Between the drivers, we all travelled together, we holidayed together, we lived a very exciting life. In those days, you know, there were no helicopters or private planes at that time, really. So we were much more of a little community who cared for each other pretty well as well, because the sport was hideously dangerous in those days. There was no safety, there was no medical care of any real sense on the circuit itself. So it was a different world, but a tremendous world of friendships. I mean, Jim Clark was one of my best friends. Obviously, Graham Hill was, Francois Sever was, Piers Courage was, Jochen Rindt was. We holidayed together, we played together. And the swinging 60s and 70s were a good time to play. Of course, the swinging 60s were always the Beatles, the Stones, and all the great, even Sinatra on a different scale, but nevertheless, great times for music. So motor racing, I think, in a funny sort of way, was more glamorous then than even it is today. It's beautifully glamorous today. But the human relationships and the people who came around. In Monaco, Princess Grace, of course, was there with Prince Rainier. She attracted all the major movie stars to come to the Grand Prix weekend. And it was at the same weekend, normally, as the Cannes Film Festival. So they all came. So whether it was Roman Polanski, whether it was Frank Sinatra, whether it was Elizabeth Taylor, in those days, it was a tremendous, I think, glamorous period. Of course, it had its bad side because so many of my friends have died. I mean, Helen, my wife of all those years, more than 60 years marriage, was my timekeeper and my lap charter. But she counted out 57 of our friends who died driving racing cars. Now, that simply doesn't happen today. And therefore, I probably went to more funerals than any other man that I know, you know, apart from the professionals. It really was peak and valley. It was glamorous, colourful, exciting, and yet sad when we lost friends. And in many cases, we saw them in these conditions, because in those days, there was nothing like the facilities that exist today. But it was a great maker of men, in a funny sort of thing, in a way. And as I say, the deep friendships that we had, the respect we had for each other at the front end of the grid, nobody was going to take any advantages in the wrong way because danger was so close. It's of course, today, wonderful Formula One. It's never been better than it is today. But in those days, it was of a different mood altogether.
Oh, you painted an incredible picture there. And I do want to talk about risk and safety and mindset. But just staying with Helen a moment, you described what sound to me like heady, exciting days. And in the middle of all this, you find the woman who remains the love of your life. You've been married more than 60 years. She did your timekeeping. What was it about Lady Stewart, as she is now, Jackie, that made you realise that she was the one and she was your lifetime co-pilot, if you like?
Well, it was a bit weird, really, because a friend of mine had set me up with a bird in the same cafe that I used to go to quite a lot. And he said, listen, you're all right there, Jackie. We'll get this one to come with you. And we were going out in my car with him and his girlfriend. And this girl was waiting for me in the cafe at Helensburgh, the radio cafe. I mean, a tremendous place, great people and great music going on all the time. She took one look at me, this girl, and said, I'm not going out with him. And this wasn't Helen.
Oh.
So my blind date suddenly developed into nothing. But my pal who had set it all up, his girlfriend was sitting ironically with Helen in the same cafe at the same time. So we sat down and I said, well, look, we're going in the car, go for a drive, the four of us. Why don't you come with me? And that was all those years ago when she was 16 and I was 18.
Oh my goodness.
Here we are still together. And, you know, we've delivered two boys and we've delivered 9 grandchildren from that radio cafe meeting.
Wow. I hope none of them on a dining table, just saying.
No, so far none of them have been left in the dining room table for birth, but they're still awfully close to us. The grandchildren are terrific. And it's a nice balance between boys and girls also. You know, that's nice in a family. 8 boys, 1 girl.
Fantastic. Sounds a perfect balance to me.
And of course, she's not spoiled at all. Motorsport has always been a very glamorous sport. In the early days and the beginning of the horseless carriage, it was only rich people that could afford cars, and then they would race between village to village and so forth. And it came on, and it's always been glamorous. It's always been colourful. It's always been exciting. And of course, it's been dangerous. And danger is a magnet in itself sometimes. Nobody likes to see death. But nevertheless, incidents and accidents at high speed is a spectacular vision. So whether it be Brooklands in the old days in the south of England or whether it be Monte Carlo, it hasn't changed. It's still an amazing sport. So the motor industry is a giant, and it was almost only motor industry for a while. Then it became fuel and oil companies that were involved. And then commercial relationships started to appear into what it is today, is probably the biggest commercial sport in the world. And it's totally global because everybody drives a car. It doesn't matter whether it's in China or whether it's in Timbuktu. Everybody drives a car. And likewise, in those days, it was mostly men that went to motor races. You know, they would go home on a Friday night and say to their wife, oh, by the way, I'm taking Willie off to a Grand Prix at Silverstone, but we'll be back around 8 o'clock at night. And she would not be going with him in those days, in the early days. That's all changed now because children are going with mummies and don't allow daddy to go away on his own. They want to be as a family unit. And that you can see in all sports, not just motor racing. I saw the other night in a football match, a whole lot of very, very young kids there with their parents. That's what modern Formula One is. And it's now probably the biggest sport in the world because it's very large. It's a vehicle. It's commercially very attractive. The sponsorships in Formula One are bigger than any other sponsorships, I think, in any other sport. So the car is still with us. It's still exciting, it's still colourful, and it's still glamorous. So all of that has happened, and the sport itself, the power of television has been incredible, and then the internet's been huge. So it's much bigger than it ever was in my day. But I'm lucky enough to still be in that world, because I'm off to Miami in a few days' time, and I'm going to one Grand Prix after another, and still, of course, going to Monaco, which is still the most glamorous Grand Prix in the world properly, I think, in most people's eyes. And, of course, Silverstone, the British Grand Prix, because the UK is the capital of motorsport technology for motorsport on a global basis. The Indy cars go to Britain to be engineered, so do they from every other country. So it's big. And, you know, the Miami race I'm going to, apparently it was sold out months ago. And now the tickets are up for sale in the usual way, selling for sometimes 200,000 to get the right ticket in the right place. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. So I'm glad that I'm still part of that world, because it's a world that I know obviously very well, and one that I've worked with in partnerships commercially. You know, I've been with Rolex now for 53 or 54 years. I've been with Moët & Chandon for 52 years. I was with Ford for 40 years.
The total design of the Mondeo, the instrument panel, newly and beautifully laid out. You can read every instrument perfectly.
I was with ABC Whitewater Sports for 20 years.
He's got it started up, and he's crossed the finishing line as well. But he's been pushed. There may be an infringement of the regulations there. Been pushed. So it'll be interesting to see what the officials have to say about this. But what a spectacular finish. We'll have to look at that finish again, because it really was a question of Richard Petty and David Pearson really moving in on each other there in the most spectacular manner in the last corner of the racetrack.
I've had a lovely kaleidoscope, if you like, of life, both on the track and in the car, and on the track and the commentary position, or in the commercial world, because my son and I put Paul Stewart Racing together from the early formulas of the sport, and then grew into Stewart Grand Prix, a Formula One car and team.
When your son Paul said that he wanted to get into the sport, how did you feel about him going into motor racing, given how very much aware you were of the risks and dangers involved?
Well, that's a very good question, because when he told me he wanted to go motor racing, I said, no, you can't do that. You just cannot do it. He said, but I want to do it. And I said, your mummy, it's not fair in your mother. She's been through it with me. I've survived, but look at the danger. And he was still at university, in Duke University, a very good one in America. And I said, look, you've got to finish your education first of all, in any case. So he started to go to get lessons on driving sports cars, racing cars, behind my back, which he paid for himself. And then suddenly he said, right, I am going motor racing. So when that happened, I said, well, I better go with him, because I wanted to have the best mechanics. I don't want cars with wheels falling off. I want the best mechanics. So I got the same mechanics as I drove. Roy Topp, one of them still alive today, not only was my mechanic, but also was Paul's mechanic. And I knew that the wheel was not going to fall off in his car with his mechanic. So he did very well, and then decided he wasn't going to make Formula One. He was not going to be able to do that. He saw it for himself. And that's when we started the racing team properly and got into Formula One. So that's been very colourful, because we had hugely successful sponsors because of my connections around the world, the government of Malaysia, the Ford Motor Company, HSBC, all sorts of big, big global names. And we did well, and we finished second at Monte Carlo in our first year, which was pretty impressive, at least to me. And then we went on to win a Grand Prix, the German and European Grand Prix, with Stewart Grand Prix as well. So, and then I sold it. We sold the company to Ford, and it went into Jaguar. And then, sadly, didn't do so well with the new ownership. But I'm still involved because of the number of partners I have commercially who are very keen on the sport, because as Rolex, they're a global company. Moët and Chandon are a global company. Heineken are a global company who I'm with also. So I'm still around. I'm still in the paddock. I'm still on the starting grid. I'm still enjoying it enormously. And it's just bigger than it's ever been before and better.
It certainly is. You mentioned, Jackie, Jim Clark, who I think I've heard you say was one of your ultimate heroes in Formula One. Didn't you learn to be smooth and gentle with the car thanks to Jim?
Exactly. Jim Clark had an enormous amount to do with, because we were both Scots, and I was able to join up with him before I ever got into Formula One because he was such a hero and I was starting, but I was winning little events, club events, and then national events. So we built a lovely relationship. We had an apartment together in London that we shared. So that closeness was fantastic. So I think I was very fortunate. I was picked up by the right people. By BRM was a very successful racing team on the day, and that was who I got my first Formula One Grand Prix victory with. And then I moved to Ken Tittle, who was an amazing man, and I won all three of my world championships with him, and it was a family relationship almost. But I think the mechanics, they were of a breed of their own, and I, being a garage mechanic, I think probably recognised and admired them more because I knew how difficult it was to be very good in that particular environment, particularly that of motorsport. These three main mechanics that I had, who are all three alive today, I hope that continues, were better at what they did than what I did. You know, my wheels didn't fall off with them. I didn't have many mechanical failures. So it takes good teamwork in a big way, as it does, of course, with any business and any relationship. It's like a marriage in a sense. And we had, you know, very good times. And Helen, of course, was part and parcel of that. She was doing all the lap charting for all of those teams that I was with, the timing as well, and a split-second stopwatch. She would be taking 26 racing cars every lap with your stopwatch. Amazing skills. And so did Betty Hill, and so did Jim Clark's many girlfriends and a whole lot of people in the sport. Their wives were playing an integral part in the team. So Helen went through all of that and saw that and lived it, and at the same time looked after two little baby boys who grew up and have turned out to be extremely well. Mark is a very good filmmaker, in fact, just now bringing a film out on me. And I haven't seen it properly yet because I think he thought it was better that I didn't, and I thought it was better that I would get surprised, I hope. So that's off any day now, actually. In our case, it was also a family thing, not only because of Helen and her timekeeping and growing the family, but also Paul coming in and experiencing another side of motorsport very successfully. And then Mark doing all the filming he's done, a lot of it in motorsport. So the sport is still very much with us.
I know you are very passionate about the Jackie Stewart Classic, which is taking place in Scotland. Tell us about that and the race against dementia, Jackie.
Well, Rolex decided it would be nice to recognise my career because I'm of a certain age. They thought it was a good idea, and I've been with them a long time. So they decided it would be good to do it in Scotland, and they decided it would be good to have an event involving all my cars that I had won championships with or raced with or won with and sometimes failed with. And we're doing it. It's called Thurliston Castle. It's a lovely castle. We're going to have a three-day event. The first day we'll have shooting because that was my sport. I shot for Scotland and I shot for Great Britain. I won the Scottish Championship twice and I won the European and Mediterranean Championship and I blah, blah, blah. But it was my biggest thing at that time. Mr. Beretta's coming up with a couple of good shots from Italy, and all the best shots in Scotland will come in, even some from England. I think we've got 17 Scottish sponsors, plus some internationals, about 24 in total. And it's all to benefit Race Against Dementia, because we need to find a cure for dementia. But I've got almost all my Formula One championship cars, but I've got all the Formula 2 cars, the GT cars, the sports cars, the cars that I started off with as puppy cars, so to speak. So we've got all of them coming and a lot of nice people. It clashes with the Grand Prix of Canada, so there won't be a lot of the Formula One people there, but a lot of other folk and a lot of major sponsors. The Ford Motor Company are involved, as well as HSBC is involved. Tannock's Caramel Wafers and what's their lovely one? Walker's Shortbread. But a whole
delicious.
Lot of them are participating. And that takes place on Saturday and Sunday. And at the same time, there's a Concours d'Elegance taking place with over 1,000 cars. And then in addition to that, there's a Red Bull Formula One car going to be driving up the sprint that we've created. And that's a competitive event of itself, not the Red Bull bit, but the actual sprint. There'll be entries to see who wins that. And of course, the Red Bull coming up with the modern sound is going to be fantastic. And we've got all my trophies from my winning days, shooting as well as driving. Lovely photographs of Helen. She was voted one of the most beautiful women in the world at that time. So Patrick Litfield drew a beautiful picture of her, as a lot of other people did. But a whole lot of photographs of our past. These are indoors because apparently sometimes it rains in Scotland. Oh, of course, I've noticed that. That's what's happening.
The reason this is so dear to your heart is your beautiful wife, Helen, is suffering with dementia, isn't she? And it's such a cruel disease. We need to work harder, don't we, to find a cure?
More people die today with dementia than any other. I mean, even more than cancer. And there's no cure for it yet. For over 50 years, the medical world, either the pharmaceutical world or the medical world itself, have failed. I want to change that. We started off a charity called Race Against Dementia. Speed we need for change. Formula One is an example of the fastest problem solving of any activity in the world at any business or any sport or any activity. From one Grand Prix to the next, 1 week sometimes apart, there'd be six major changes. That does not happen in medicine. So we're calling it Race Against Dementia, and we're using Red Bull and McLaren as examples. We pick up young PhDs, the best PhDs. Because of the internet now, we can find the best medical universities and then the highest rated PhD of that year. I think we've now got 10 or 11 of them scattered around the world. We've got them in America, we've got them in Australia, we've got them Holland and Scotland, obviously, and England and so forth. And we get people to raise money for Race Against Dementia in all sorts of different ways. But the big event at Thurveston Castle is to benefit Race Against Dementia. We've got to find a cure. We'll have our PhDs there as well. And that's a good thing for them to see what's going on and how you get things done quickly, even for an event of that kind, and how well it's carried out, etc. How good the music will be or how good the trophies are, to try and explain to everybody how you can improve, and most of all, the medical world. So we've got our PhDs coming over also in July from Australia, from everywhere. And it's a charity. We've got British Airways are giving us four of our PhDs from Australia at their cost so they can come over and they'll be visiting Red Bull and McLaren. They'll be visiting other people of tremendous skills mentally to show them how they must do it differently than their forefathers or even their fathers or mothers. They've got to do it better because they've failed. So motorsport's faster at problem solving than anything else, particularly Formula One. And it's a global illness, and motorsport's a global sport. I'm a sort of global man. And so therefore, we're raising quite a lot of money by doing this. James Dyson, for example, is our biggest contributor, and he's a fantastic idol for most people because he created what he's got today and continues to bring out new products all the time, always better. So people like he is helping our PhDs, counselling their PhDs. His wife is a counsellor for one of our PhDs. So we get people to give them the opportunity. I'm going to the Mayo Clinic where we've got two PhDs, and I want to see what they're doing, what their equipment they have. In the Mayo Clinic, they've got better equipment than any other facility I know in the world. So we've got two of them in there, mostly women, by the way. We've got a very bright Australian man and spoke at a fundraising event we had in Melbourne, the Grand Prix. We had 800 people seated for dinner, and I had to speak naturally, and so did other people. But our PhD spoke, that young man, and he spoke, I thought it was Churchill, he spoke so well. So we teach them to go to public speaking courses. We dress them by Hugo Boss so that they're well presented when they see their suppliers, that's to say the people who are giving us money for Race Against Dementia. We've got to present ourselves correctly. And when they go to see a Formula One garage, and it's a factory now, not a garage, they employ 1,100 people in Red Bull, 1,100 people, not an engine, that's different. Mercedes-Benz have 1,200 people and then another 1,100 people just for the engine. So that technology is so rapid and so changing, it's a good example for these young people. So therefore, we're having all these conferences at Silverstone, and the Hilton Hotel at the Grand Prix circuit is putting them up. So lots of people are helping us, but we need more help. We need more funding to bring more PhDs in. But I want to have it happen in my life. I want to see a cure for dementia.
Oh, it's been an honour. It's been a joy. You've got so many wonderful stories. And I'm hoping, perhaps in Scotland, I hope at some point to meet you in person and shake your hand. Thank you so much.
Well, that's not much my pleasure. It's not often I get to be with a blonde for that length of time nowadays.
You've been listening to Formula One legend Sir Jackie Stewart. And he's about to host the Sir Jackie Stewart Classic in Scotland, featuring some of his championship racing cars, live motorsport action, and his shooting trophies to raise money and awareness for Race for Dementia, which he started for very personal reasons. On next week's episode, Sir Jackie talks about how his severe dyslexia helped him take the emotion out the night before a race, how he and his wife Helen coped with the tragic loss of their racing driver friends on the track, the safety improvements Sir Jackie worked hard to bring in, even though he wasn't always popular for it, and the story of how he started the familiar sight of spraying champagne on the winner's podium by accident. Download and subscribe to our series at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple and Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to yours. Join me for more incredible insight into Formula One next week.